This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us for the Ed Johnson Conversations, Part 6. In 1906, Ed Johnson, a young black man, was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted of a crime he did not commit here in Chattanooga, the assault and rape of Nevada Taylor, a young white woman. Johnson's case reached the United States Supreme Court, which issued a stay of execution, but a violent mob took the law into its own hands and lynched him on the Walnut Street Bridge. From his arrest, through his trial, to the final moments of his life, Ed Johnson said, again and again, "I am an innocent man." We are bringing you a series of conversations with members of the Ed Johnson Project about his story from more than a century ago and the memorial in this century at the south end of the bridge where his life ended. This hour, we conclude our series with the Project's Marianne Martin, Eric Atkins, and Steve Durthick talking about that memorial. Eric, Steve, Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for your series on the Ed Johnson Project. We're really happy to be here with you.
Yes, we're very happy to be here, Ray. And this has been a quite interesting series that we've done. So I think we've been able to tell the story completely and accurately. So thank you again.
Well, thank you. And to everybody from the Ed Johnson Project, whom we've had conversations with over these past few weeks, I want to focus on the project during this conversation. How did the project come to be?
It was kind of probably divine intervention, I would say. And let me first start out that it sort of built on the work of others, because you do have to give Leroy Phillips and Mark Curran credit for contempt of court, because that sort of did put the Ed Johnson story back to a new generation of people.
Phillips and Curran wrote the book about the Ed Johnson case, published in 1999.
And so it did raise public awareness and consciousness. Freddie Thurkill was very instrumental, and David Young, you can't forget his role in the Pleasant Garden Cemetery, maintaining it.
Pleasant Gardens Cemetery in Chattanooga is where Ed Johnson was buried.
But it was all almost in disrepair. You would go there and you would see graves that were sunken, trees that were knocked over, the soil had eroded. I like to think from the perspective of the Ed Johnson Project, everybody sort of built on the work of their predecessor. And the way this committee got started, I remember that I was talking to Representative Joanne Favors one Saturday afternoon about some research that I had conducted, and she thought that if we worked together, we could get a resolution passed through the state legislature, and that was House Resolution 701.
The resolution, approved by the Tennessee General Assembly in 2016, recognized the lynching of Ed Johnson while honoring his memory and those who pursued justice for him, among them Stiles Hutchins and Noah Pardon, his African-American attorneys here in Chattanooga.
I was very anxious to get that resolution passed, and it was funny because the legislature was debating the bust of Forrest and Confederate monuments at the same time, so I wasn't sure where exactly this was going to go. But it was that last week of March it started to make through the process, and by, I think it was March 28th or somewhere around there, the resolution passed 93-0, and she sent me the resolution through the mail, and it was this great big thing. I still have one on my wall right now. And from there, what I noticed is that Representative Gerald McCormick's name was right next to hers, even in this volatile political climate. You know, they're still debating the bus of force now in the state capitol. And so from there, what happened is that we passed on copies of that resolution to certain people. Other people started to get the consciousness that we need to do more than just simply receive a resolution. Now, it was important because of the state's role in this case. You have to remember Governor Cox was one of the ones that offered a $300 bounty for the head of whoever raped Nevada Taylor. That helped to incite the violence there, the state's role in it, as well as the subsequent trials that happened. And so the state had a role, but when they paid a respectful tribute and acknowledgement to the memory of Ed Johnson and to the role of his attorneys, I think that that was a weight that was lifted off of this community that now we can start to be able to discuss and repair some of the harm that was done with this case. And I remember that Moses Friedman came to me and said, "I want you to meet two people." And I'm like, "Who are these two people you want me to meet?" And of course, it was Marianne and Steve there. And so we all got together. I think it was maybe three or four times we met in little restaurants around town. And let me say, Joe Rowe was important too, because Mr. Rowe was one of my close friends and confidants. And he saw right away that if you got this resolution through the state legislature, that you had to spur forward in the healing and redemption process. And so he was very instrumental in getting that first meeting going. There's one more point is that we decided to have a ceremony to, acknowledge this. And we invited several public officials. We invited Pastor Matt Daniel. And of course, we were there. It was funny, Ray, because we were actually supposed to have that ceremony at the Walnut Street Bridge. But the weather was West Tennessee weather. It was doing all sort of funny stuff that day. It was raining, sun. I don't even know, it might have been flurries that day. So we decided to have the ceremony down to Bishop Smithson at the last minute. Well, half the crowd went down to the Walnut Street Bridge anyway. But we end up meeting at the Benson Smith Center. And from there, the conversations grew more and more, and the committee began to form.
And Steve, Marianne, tell us more about your roles in this.
It was really the culmination and built off of several other people who had been involved in telling the Ed Johnson story for decades. The Contempt of Court book. Then Leroy Phillips took LeFrederick under his wing, and LeFrederick got involved in the work and began the cemetery cleanups at Pleasant Gardens, and then developed the scholarship and also wrote the play, Dead Innocent, about Ed Johnson. And Linda DeVoisin had been working for years on her documentary about the life of Ed Johnson. Eric and Joe Rowe had been working on the resolution. And then I first heard about this story when I read David Cook's January 18th, 2015 article in the Times Free Press, Why Some Chattanoogans Won't Walk Across the Walnut Street Bridge. And when I read that, I was astounded that I had grown up in Chattanooga, gone to school for 12 years in Chattanooga, and had never heard this story. And so it lit something in me that I wanted to get involved in helping make this memorial happen. And I feel like David Cook's article and David Cook's work in general has really helped pull together several different folks who've been passionate about telling Ed Johnson's story. And so when I read the article, I read about a teacher at Virginia College named Marianne Martin, who used the Contempt of Court book to teach her students. And many of her students are quoted in David's article saying, "How do we not know this story? We've lived here all our lives." And that's exactly how I felt. And so one of the first people I called was Marianne. And also it connected me with Eric. As Eric said, Moses Freeman got us together. And so I think that David Cook's article is one of the things that helped pull together lots of folks who've been working on this for decades with others of us who had never heard the story before, but said, we need to help make this happen. We need to come together to create this memorial.
Marianne, that brings us to you.
It's really interesting when you think about this. And I think that's one of the powerful things about the Ed Johnson Project, is that all of us have come at this in different ways and from different perspectives and become a part of this effort from our own points of view, but all have this passion about the fact that this story has been overlooked and discounted and not told for so long. You know, this story that has national importance and is taught in law schools because of its legal precedent, but Chattanooga has not acknowledged it. And as Steve mentioned, when I moved to Chattanooga in 2011, I was handed a copy of the book by Leroy Phillips and Mark Cureton. I read the book. I thought it was a fascinating story. I immediately emailed Mark Cureton and wanted to know if Chattanooga had any memorials or markers for Ed Johnson, or if there was any further work after his book. And then found out that there wasn't. And it kind of sat on my back burner for the rest of the time. I had sort of internally pledged that I would see a memorial or a marker created before I left Chattanooga. And then that sort of developed into when I was teaching, as I began to use this story and just saw the passion of my students. I mean, just credit to so many of my students who were young and they were, struggling to go to school, and most of them were working, but just their passion and also their anger that they had been deprived of this part of their history. Many of them were African-American students. And I still just remember one of them talking about, you know, if I had heard this story, if I had known about the role models, and I know Cameron Williams also talks about this a lot, you know, growing up, he didn't have Ed Johnson and Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins as role models and heroes because he wasn't told this story. It's not part of Chattanooga history. And so just seeing their passion and knowing how much this would have meant to them to be able to know this story is really what drove me. And then as Steve and Eric have detailed starting those conversations, I still remember Joe Rowe, for those of you that know him, I knew him only briefly, but just such a wonderful man. And I remember him coming up to me after the Bessie Smith and just saying, Marianne, we need you to be a part of this. And just those encouraging words, you know, and has driven me over all those years. Unfortunately, he passed away very shortly after that and will not see this happen. But certainly his early work was very instrumental in this as well.
Tell us more about how we arrived at the memorial at the south end of the bridge.
Steve had mentioned one time date, but just to put a little bit more of a time frame on this, 2016 is when those first meetings, the meeting at the Bessie happened, those first conversations. The Ed Johnson Committee first met in July of 2016 as a committee, was the first time we had met as a group. And I'll let actually Steve and Eric talk a little bit more about going from a marker to a memorial, because the first conversations were a marker and then how we got to a memorial, and they were very closely involved in that. So I'll let them talk about that.
Marianne is correct. When we first met, I remember that, you know, we had came together and we had actually wrote out a proposal to the Tennessee Historical Commission to get a state historical marker. Looking around the room, you know, people were sort of, you know, it's sort of like the kid that wants cookies but gets broccoli. You know, everybody sort of had their heads down and you could just feel a black cloud over the room. And finally, when people opened up and confessed, you know, people thought that we needed to do more than just a marker in the ground, because that would not suffice. And I remember, I guess it might have been a year after we met, that when we had one of the annual bridge commemorations on March 19th, we always like to acknowledge and recognize that date, because that's the day that Ed Johnson was actually hung from the bridge. And I think that first one, when we had a replaying ceremony down there, it might have been 500 people or more. I mean, the bridge was very crowded on that end that you're talking about, Ray. From there, you know, just the swell of people and the support that we was getting. In my mind, right away, we had to push for a memorial, because the people wanted something, an acknowledgement, a recognition that could be easily visible and that would be clearly understood. But a lot of times when you go past historical markers, a lot of times you don't even stop to look at it. You might look at the name or the date, but it doesn't resonate. And so from those early bridge ceremonies that we had, as well as some of the collaborations that we've had, we've done guided tours down there. Some of the UTC students, that was probably the most profound bridge experience I had, when Dr. Tammy's an English professor. If I forget her name, she's going to kill me. But she had a group of students there, and it was small, but it was very intimate, just the look on the students' faces, because Steve and Marianne is right. When people realize that they don't even recognize the story and pass that bridge every day, it's sort of, you know, it's like, where the hell have I been all my life? That's what some of the looks on the faces actually demonstrate to you. And they want to know more about the story after they learn just a smidgen of an aspect. And so to answer your question, those bridge ceremonies that we've had down there was when I realized that we had to have more than just a mark.
Also in that article by David Cook, he mentions a plaque or a piece of public art. So I think that's maybe been in the background in the conversations from the beginning. But the more we talked about a piece of public art, everyone seemed to be more excited about a public art memorial than a plaque. So the idea really took off. As far as why at the south end of the bridge, well, of course, that's the location where Ed Johnson was lynched. When we first, I remember with Eric and Marianne and others, as we first started some conversations with different stakeholders, particularly in that area of the riverfront, there was some real hesitancy to have a memorial, a lynching-related memorial, some real hesitation of why would we want to to acknowledge this or have something in this location that's the heart of downtown Chattanooga and the tourist district. But it's amazing, over 2 or 3 years, the momentum built. And I think people began to understand that this memorial is about, although it's a place of mourning, a tragic event, there's also a powerful inspiration in the story of Ed Johnson, his last words. That was noteworthy to me, that first there was a real hesitancy about having this memorial in that location. And I remember we were there with the sculptor Isaac Duncan one day, and we said, "Isaac, where should this memorial be?" Because we were looking and there just didn't seem to be a place. And he pointed to exactly where the memorial is going to be. And he says, "It needs to be right there." I think it was a spot that was somewhat hidden, that a lot of us had never noticed, that there's actually a fair amount of land right there next to the bridge where the memorial is now being built. That's how we got here.
And that's a metaphor for the Ed Johnson story, a patch of hidden land to reveal a long hidden story.
Well, that story was always known in the Black community, Ray. My godmother, she lived to be 101. You know, she had told me about the story when I was just a child. A lot of Black people always knew of some of these atrocities, but you didn't speak of it. And I imagine because of it probably had a traumatic effect throughout the years. And I know Joy DeGruy speaks of post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I think that a lot of these lynchings, you sort of had a post-traumatic stress too. I was just looking at Roots yesterday and noticed how, you know, the end of that story speaks of how the Klan came through to get, you know, Alice Hayden's family. And you have to remember that they did have these instances of racial terror and intimidation. They were meant to send a message. You know, Ed Johnson actually was sending a message. He was sending a message to Supreme Court, because they wrote on there after they shot him, I think it was more than 50 times, you know, "John Marshall Harlan, come get him now." They wrote that note to the Supreme Court. So they were sending a message then. And that's what racial terror was. It was intimidation. It was threatening. It was stoking fear. And I think, like I said, it sort of traumatized not only that generation, but the generation after that, because you were told it was oral history. And African-American history, you know, going back to the African tradition, a lot of things are told orally. And so you knew about this story. Not only that, but I know you were asking why that end of the bridge. We know that they picked the second span. Alfred Blunt was actually hung, I think it was 1896. I could be wrong about that day. But he was actually hung from the bridge first. And the mob that took Ed Johnson out of the jail was aware of that. That's why they hung him from the second span of the bridge, knowing full well that Alfred Blunt was hung from the first span of the bridge. And so we always knew that somewhere toward that end of the Walnut Street Bridge is where something was going to have to be reminded. But I always think of Alfred Blunt too when I go to the bridge, because I look at those long spans and I'm like, God, they actually knew that Alfred Blunt hung from this first span, so they consciously hung Ed Johnson from the second span. And that's something that always dawns on me as well.
The memorial references that. It's not just about Ed Johnson and the Ed Johnson story.
Yes, the memorial has three figures going down the slope of the hill that acknowledge other lynchings. At the time that the memorial was created, we knew of three other lynchings. We have since found at least two additional ones, but the name of those figures are those yet unnamed, sort of acknowledging that there are probably numerous additional ones as well, because it is important. While Ed Johnson's story is also important for the legal significance and his lawyers, there are certainly additional lynchings that happened not only at the bridge, other places. One was in St. Elmo, one was in Soddy Daisy, that we want to acknowledge and remember through this memorial. And particularly thinking of Alfred Blount, you know, he didn't even have a trial. He was hung, I think it was the first or second night he was placed in jail, also most certainly innocent and very little evidence, and hung without a trial. So a very tragic story there as well.
And all of this underscores how the memorial and the story of Ed Johnson, what needs to be remembered by everybody, is not limited just to completing the memorial and telling the story of Ed Johnson, those steps are just the next steps in telling the full story throughout the generations.
Well, I think we've been helped greatly, Ray, by the work of the Equal Justice Initiative. And it's sort of, like I was telling you, sort of divine intervention. Because it's funny, because at the same time we were doing this work, it was sort of a osmosis effect happening all over the country. Whether it's Elaine recognizing that massacre, I forget the town, I think it was close to Orlando, Florida. I know Marianne would know about that more. But all over the country, it's been a push to actually recognize and acknowledge some of these atrocities. And I think that the work of the Equal Justice Initiative greatly helped, especially their report of the legacy of lynching. When they came out and documented that over 4,000, I think it's 4,700 now, the numbers keep going up. But when they documented that report, it was just very eye-opening and revealing that almost in every county, in every location of this country, every haven, every hamlet, they had one of these instances. Tennessee, especially, the worst one I might have seen in Tennessee is Jim McHerron in Esther Springs. Horrible what happened to Jim McHerron. But Jane Weldon Johnson would actually go to Woodrow Wilson in the Oval Office and actually use the Jim McHerron case as one of those first pretenses to the NAACP's 30 years of lynching fight. Because he had asked Woodrow Wilson, have you heard of Jim McHerron? And Woodrow Wilson was like, who is Jim McHerron? I don't know his name. And Jane Weldon Johnson is famous for storming out the office and say, we'll make you know his name. And that was part of the 30 years of lynching with the NAACP. But to answer your question, I know we're getting other territory here. Other locations across the country were doing this work. And I think that the EJI sort of served as a catalyst. And we actually had a community remembrance project in collaboration with the EGI. And so some of the other victims that Mary Ann has talked about, we actually went to the locations of where they were lynched and actually placed soil in a jar. And some of that soil is down there at the EGI's new National Museum of Peace and Justice, as well as I think we have three or four columns down there of some of those victims too. But the names keep adding up the more research you do.
In this final conversation of our series, we are talking about the Ed Johnson Memorial at the south end of Chattanooga's Walnut Street Bridge. Joining us from the Ed Johnson Project are Eric Atkins, Steve Durthick, and Mary Ann Martin. What do you think had changed enough in this community to create the space to move forward with this memorial? Was it just the passage of time? Was it just later generations? How do you all see that?
That's a really interesting question, Ray. And I don't know that I really have an answer of how it changed or what changed. I think it's certainly national conversations, as Eric referenced, with EJI and just an awareness in passing generations. But I'm grateful to see the change in the conversations, even just in the 5 short years that we've been doing this, where there is a greater understanding of why this history matters and how important it is to remember this just as a way of healing and reconciliation for our communities, that it must be talked about. I know when we started this conversation, there were a lot of people that said to us, why do you want to bring up this history? Why do you want to bring up these horrific acts? Chattanooga doesn't want to be remembered for this. This is not who we are. But I think communities are starting to realize this is who we are and this is who we have been. And, you know, John Lewis, I don't have it in front of me and I can't quote it, but John Lewis spoke during a dedication, I think it was at Harvard, where he said, for 400 years, we have tried to bury these truths and our very bones are crying out. And it is something that our country must reckon with. It is something our communities must reckon with, because we all know that when there are wounds and when there are horrific things that have happened, we can't just pretend that they haven't and go on. The only way is to talk about them, to recognize them, and then to seek to find ways to heal together. And so I think that it is really important that Chattanooga has finally come to this place where we can have this space to do this, and that there is awareness in the community to do this.
I think that Mary Ann is right. And as we began our conversation, we talked about the shoulders that we're standing on, the folks who have worked for decades, Leroy Phillips' book, LaFrederick's play, Linda DeVoisin's documentary. I think we're building on that. And our project, thanks to Linda's generosity, showed a rough cut of her documentary to hundreds of people in Chattanooga over the past few years. And I believe that all those things have begun, and the national conversation that Eric talked about race and a reckoning with our racial past, that all those things have built to create this space in Chattanooga. And Brian Stevenson, who Eric mentioned, the EJI, has been such an inspiration and a support to what we're doing here. And Brian Stevenson, in a recent interview, was talking about planning for the dedication of the National Museum for Peace and Justice that honors the lynching victims in the country. And he said that he was so worried about the dedication and the weather being right and that everything would go well. And that right as he got up to give his keynote address, the clouds broke and the rain started pouring down. And at first he panicked, and then he had this overwhelming sense that this was what was meant to be, that this pouring down of rain was the tears of people throughout the generations who have suffered, whose names are finally being spoken and honored in this museum. So I think it is the culmination and continuing work of so many people that have created, I guess, really a space in each of us. It's really created a space in each of us to be open to reckoning with things in our past that people like me were clueless about. I had no idea that Ed Johnson was lynched, or that 6 or 8 or 10 others were lynched in Chattanooga. And when I spoke with Moses Freeman, he said, "Steve, it wasn't just Ed Johnson that was affected by this. All of us African Americans were affected by this. I was affected by this," he told me. "I was 12 years old riding my bike in Chattanooga when a police officer grabbed me by the back of my shirt and threw me on the ground off my bike." And he said, "I was one when if an African American man went out with a white woman, you were targeted, you know, if you were dating someone." So anyway, it's created a space for us individually and collectively, I think, to hear about our history that some of us were clueless about.
And on one end, you know, you get all of this upheaval over racial justice, whether it's a police brutality or racial profiling or mass incarceration. And on the other end of the spectrum, it's a desire for people to actually do better. And my hope right now is in the young people, because I've seen the young people stand up. You know, they get a bad rap too. Now, I don't even know what generation we call this, the computer gig generation. I don't know. But they have stood up against many injustices, whether it's the gun violence. You know, because we looked at some of the Parkland students that just want background checks and ban on assault weapons and these sort of things. Some of the students have stood up for racial justice, whether that's a George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Trayvon Martin, even going back 10 years ago. And I think this generation finally is going to put Dr. King's dream into practice. They do believe in being multiracial and multiethnic and being judged by the content of your character, not the color of your skin. It's a very pluralistic generation that we're in now that won't be defined by the past either. They want to embark upon a new future. And that's what I tell the young people all the time when the Constitution was wrote. Now, it wasn't talking about people like me, and it wasn't talking about people like Mary Ann then, at that time. But that is the redemptive quality of time, too, because now when you say we the people, we have a problem if you don't include women and minorities and poor people and homeless people, because it said we the people. It don't say who we the people are. I say we the people, so that means all of us. And the great charge of democracy is to do exactly what the preamble tells us to do. The first thing that we must do, we the people of the United States, is to form a more perfect union. And that is what we all must be doing. And it even tells us what we should be doing, how we achieve that. First, we have to establish justice. And that's why you have to be out and people are protesting. That's why people, they write letters to go down to the council. And the students have a powerful voice too, the young people. And they do it differently, I admit. I must be getting old now because they do it a little differently than I do. But my hope is in the young people because they really envision a much different country than what we were. That's why when we have events like Charlottesville and what happened at the U.S. Capitol was so scary, because we don't want to go back to the past. Because as Dr. King said, evil begets evil, hate begets hate, darkness begets darkness. And if we live in the past, we're going to repeat it. And so my hope is that the young people will keep pressing us forward.
When the memorial is complete, when people see the memorial, sculpted by Jerome Meadows of Savannah, describe for people who may be hearing about the memorial for the first time, or they've heard about the memorial, but they haven't seen any designs. When that memorial is complete and they were to go down there, what would they see and what should they take away from it?
The design itself is three life-size statues of Ed Johnson, who was lynched, and of Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins, his two African-American attorneys who risked their own lives to try to save his life. And that is what the memorial depicts. Ed Johnson is walking away from the bridge where he was lynched. He is stepping on a noose, the noose that hung him. He is stepping on that noose as he walks away, free. But I think it's Stiles Hutchins who is reaching for his hand, but not being able to grasp it to show that they were not able to save him. But Noah Pardon holds a copy of the Constitution to show that the Supreme Court upheld his rights as a man and that he did have the right to a fair trial and he did have the rights that were afforded to white people at the time. The mob interceded and hung him, so he was not given those rights, but this case still represents those rights that the Supreme Court did give him. And so there's a lot of symbolism of the entire story in those three figures there. There's hope with Ed Johnson walking away, but there's also sadness of the fact that the attorneys were not able to save his life. And then there are also story walls that will tell very briefly, there's a lot in this story, but that will tell very briefly about this story and where people can go to learn more. Another thing that Jerome Meadows has often spoken of in this story is kind of the exactly what Eric was talking about right now, is the struggle between 1906, when this story happened, and 2021, when this memorial will be unveiled, and how to create a space that takes us back to 1906 to remember that story, but still acknowledge the year that we are living in today and the work that continues today. So the memorial is in a space set apart, but is still in the middle of Chattanooga, in the middle of the 21st century, acknowledging where we are today. So Jerome often speaks of kind of that juxtaposition that he has tried to put into the work, those two different centuries of where we are.
And the first thing the visitor will see as she walks into the memorial is Ed Johnson's hand outstretched, welcoming the visitor to take Ed Johnson's hand and join him in walking.
Steve, can you talk about the three words there? See, you do that so well.
The three words that will be engraved on the memorial entrance wall are remembrance, reconciliation, and healing. And those have been three central words to our Ed Johnson project, because we believe that it's important to remember and acknowledge our difficult racial past in order to move forward towards reconciliation and healing.
And you know, Ray, Steve talked about how inspirational Brian Stevenson has been. You know, he also, when he started the EGI, you know, he was going and trying to get people free from jail. But he has a knack of saying often in his speeches that you can't have any reconciliation without having truth tell. You can't have any redemption until you do that. So first we have to acknowledge and tell the truth about what happens. And that's sort of therapeutic when you release some of those negative connotations within yourself in order to let the healing begin. If you ever been to a situation where you know that you have to have, you know, any sort of therapy, first you have to acknowledge actually that it's something that is wrong, that is something that needs to be repaired and fixed before you can actually work on what's broken or what's problematic. So that's the first step. You tell the truth. And then once you do that, healing can begin.
And again, this memorial and the story that it tells is a necessary step forward, a long overdue step forward, but by no means the last word or the final step.
We're doing what the Constitution tells us to do. Like I go back to it, being a more perfect union. Now, that's a very difficult proposition because the historical context you have to look at things, the time you have to look at things. We're in the midst of a great national debate right now. And some people have said that the soul of the country is on the line. And I do believe that. I do believe that the soul of the country is on the line. What type of country are we going to be? And we have to address that question every once in a while, whether it was during the Revolutionary War. In 1828, you saw during the Great Nullification Crisis, that crisis between Jackson and Calhoun, where the country almost came apart. And then you would get the Compromise of 1850 that almost came apart again. You would get the Civil War. The country did come apart. The Jim Crow era almost brought us apart. The Civil Rights Movement tried to bring us together. And so we have to answer these great national questions every once in a while. But I have faith in the American people. And I have faith in the citizens of this community. It ain't that we always get it right. But in the end, I think we will get it right because at our core, and I like what President George W. Bush said, we are a good and just people. And in the end, I believe that's going to prevail, as well as the spirit and the consciousness of the young people. We'll get there. It's not going to be that. You won't have to bear a heavy cross. It's not going to be you won't have to cross your rivers. It's always struggle. Frederick Douglass said, you can't have progress without half struggle. Without struggle, there is no progress. And so we'll get there. It's not going to be easy, but we will get there because I think that the people was inside them will get us there.
One thing that we have started having conversations in the Ed Johnson Project Committee is how the memorial is only the beginning. This memorial will be there in downtown Chattanooga. People will see it, will be reminded of the story. But as Eric said, the work must continue in the community with conversations with where do we go from here? How do we create a more perfect union? So this is definitely our hope in the committee is that this is only the beginning of this conversation and this healing and coming together.
I just thought Mary Ann said it so well. It's like the newsletter that we sent out looking at the work in Maryland about how a memorial is not enough. A memorial is a beginning to have conversations about what does repair look like. So our committee is looking forward to taking that next step. We don't know what it looked like yet, but we realize that the memorial is a beginning point and that it will be a place for conversation and moving forward together, hopefully.
And if I can piggyback off that, you know, one of the questions I always get often when we're telling the story of Ed Johnson, they say, well, why would the people allow that then? What were they doing? And I tell them that the people did do something. As we said last conversation, Ray, they stayed home. And it don't seem like there's a lot right now, but it took a lot of courage then to stay home, especially when you're talking about, you know, the mob violence and being intimidated, being fired, being blackballed.
We're talking about what did the black community do immediately after the lynching.
Right. They stayed home from work as a form of protest. And you don't think that was powerful, but it was newspapers that took notice of that. If you look at some of the stories, the Black community was actually criticized for staying home because, you know, it did shut down a lot of the economic commerce, so to speak. And 3,000 of them also went to the march. Let me say that. Ed Johnson's procession, there was over 3,000 of them that actually showed up in public. And that was another form of, another message sent that we don't agree with this atrocity. And what I want, if we don't do anything else or say anything else, that when the memorial is built, at least the generation that come after us will say and will see that we were resolved to do something, the people of this community. Because they're not just the Ed Johnson members of our committee that actually is a part of it. You're a part of this, right? Just by telling the story, you are part of it. So like you said, David Cook is a part of it. All the people from Benwood and all of the foundations that donated are a part of it. All of the churches are a part of it. I think that we showed the documentary, I want to say we're over 50 times now, to where we just went out to separate churches and community centers and houses, and people gathered together just to watch the documentary. That was over 50 times. They are a part of it. The person that gave $1, the person that gave $10,000 are a part of it. And so this is very much a people's and a citizen's memorial. We all had a role in it. And that is what I hope comes out of this, is that just like those people over 100 years ago stayed home, that people will recognize now that the people of this community actually stood up and something was actually done about this time. Not only to repair the harm, but to be a symbol, a beacon of light, so to speak, that now we can progress and go forward. That direction is undefined, but that's for the young people to define. But this community now, this is a symbol that we can go forward and progress shall prevail.
All right. Eric, Marianne, Steve, thank you so much for this conversation. Thanks to all of you at the Ed Johnson Project for the series of conversations that we have had together.
Thank you, Ray.
Well, thank you.
We do say thank you, Ray. Like I said, you and I have a role in this project now. And this series is very important, just getting the message out. So thank you.
We look forward to more conversations down the road after the memorial is complete and whatever the project decides to focus on next. Thank you.
To listen to our entire series of the Ed Johnson Conversations, visit our website, wutc.org. Here's the link, www.wutc.org/topic/Ed-Johnson-Conversations. Once again, that's www.wutc.org/topic/Ed-Johnson-Conversations. Our thanks to Marianne Martin, Eric Atkins, Steve Durthick, all the members of the Ed Johnson Project, and to Tony R. Smith Sr., Willie Kitchens, and their fellow musicians for I Am an Innocent Man, the Ed Johnson song. Visit the Ed Johnson Project at its website, edjohnsonproject.com, and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
A 1906 conviction yielded an unjust prediction. A black man sold Ed Johnson Railroad by a white man's jurisdiction. Chattanooga, Tennessee changed history on the Walnut Street Bridge for what he allegedly did. Truth failed in his living, but prevailed from his misgiving. Yeah, God bless you all. I am an innocent man. innocent man. Print by the press caused the town's unrest. Made front page news with a vengeance. Black on white with a woman that ain't right. A crime that brought a death sentence. Family not allowed,
oh, no,
in this unfair trial. A courtroom filled with whiteness. Taken from a jail and led to a hell. On a bridge filled with darkness. Truth fell in his living.
Oh, yes.
But prevailed from his misgiving.
Oh, yeah.
God bless you all.
Bless you all.
I am an innocent man. I took the fall. I am an innocent man.
Innocent man.
The high court appeal did not seem quite real. Never thought that day would ever come.
Never thought it would come.
Jail execution was the court's solution. His attorneys knew he had won.
He had won.
Asked to confess, he said, God bless. I am an innocent man.
I'm an innocent man.
Under the moon, a black man gone too soon. They hung an innocent man.
I am an innocent man.
Truth fell in his living.
Oh, yes, it did.
But prevailed from his misgiving.
Misgiving, yeah.
God bless you all. An innocent man.
I knew I'm an innocent man. Yes, I am.
I took the fall. I am an innocent man.
Take the blame for it all.
God bless you all.
Oh yeah.
I am an innocent man.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.